So, you know, Putin is looking that he has to hitch his wagon to a star and do it on the best terms possible. And there's a lot of rivalry that's going on. Just to go back to the question of the U.S. role in this period, I think that a lot of what's been happening, and very few people see this, but I think a lot of it has been directed at China. And if you go back to the Kosovo War again, it was no accident that the U.S. bombed the Chinese embassy in Yugoslavia, in Serbia, you know, and various other measures. When you look at what was going on, for example, under, and this is stuff that's been in Turning the Tide. Maybe I should plug the newspaper, but, Turning the Tide is the Journal of Anti-Racist Action. I edit it. And, going back to the whole struggle about, impeachment of Bill Clinton, what was at play there? And if you look, it's very, very clear. Clinton was proposing a neo-colonial line towards China. He wanted to really backpedal the human rights stuff and various other things and kind of strike a deal with the Chinese regime. The Republicans were like rabid, hardcore anti, you know, it was like they were pushing all this stuff about we have to be able to sell Bibles in China and we have to, you know, we can't have trade and so on and so forth. And they cut a deal, essentially, around the Clinton impeachment thing where His line changed dramatically after they let him off the hook. And it became, I mean, but the Republicans also moderated slightly what they were doing. And so, you know, the whole question of letting China into the WTO and so on, you know, then moved forward on this basis of, you know, a very problematic relation. And so, you know, when they're looking at it, that what some of the things they're trying to do is they're looking at, again, the question of white world supremacy. This is not a very white world anymore. I mean, there's over a billion Chinese, over a billion Indians. You know, there's a different, you know, there's a billion Muslims and 90% of them are non-white, you know. And so Europe and the United States, you know, there's sort of these enclaves are looking at this thing and trying to figure out how to deal with that and how do they maintain an empire and a relationship of domination in a world that is demographically increasingly different from Europeans. So they are striving for different kinds of neo-colonial and, through imposition of military might, trying to settle on relations that they can maintain this empire through several generations of struggle. And there's controversies. For example, it's a guy, Samuel Huntington. I don't know if people know him at all, but Huntington is a sort of a philosopher of the Trilateral Commission, which was the U.S., Japan, and Canada basically trying to trying to figure out how to divide the world up. And Huntington has put forward very strongly for several years this idea of the clash of cultures, that in the wake of the Cold War, what's going on in the world now is Islam versus the West, really, and puts out this idea that democracy is essentially something that's only suited to Anglo cultures and European cultures, and that the rest of the world, we don't have to worry about that too much, and we can't expect them to, but we have to be contesting with them. That's one view. That's a very openly racist view. I think what's predominating now is a different view, and you see it, which is that they want to find elements within those societies that will accommodate themselves to U.S. imperial ambitions and empire in general.
You were talking about Huntington and the you know, his thoughts about our clash of cultures that we're having mm-hmm. now. I wonder if you could just expand a little bit about on that.
Well, Huntington is someone who's always been a fairly openly racist and reactionary theoretician for the ruling class. He's as I say, he's aligned with the Trilateral Commission, and in the probably the early 70s or maybe mid 70s, wrote a book about the excess of democracy, which was an official Trilateral Commission document. I think originally it was co-written by him and a European and a Japanese scholar. And that put forward the notion that in the 60s there had been an excess of democracy and that too many marginalized people were being brought into the system, and this was destabilizing social control and raising demands that could not be met. And pretty specifically talking about Black, Puerto Rican, Native American, you know, other Latino, Asian American groups. And the strategy he put forward at that time was kind of a multi-part strategy. But one thing it did was it looked at the difference between the United States, to some extent, Europe and third world countries. And he said, looking around the world, what you would see is that the poor people are out on the periphery. On a global scale, that's true. But if you looked at Brazil or Argentina or, you know, the big cities of the third world, the way they were designed is that the people at the center were the well-to-do. And the poor people, the impoverished, were people in shanty towns on the outskirts. And that it was extremely problematic for the United States that it was designed the other way around, that the inner cities, where on the one hand the great wealth commercially was concentrated, the population that lived around that great corporate wealth was extremely rebellious, impoverished people of color, to the extent that we saw in the 60s that the army was marching in Detroit and D.C. and, you know, the National Guard was called out all around the country. And so his strategy for that was something he called spatial deconcentration. They wanted to break up the concentrations of poor people in the inner cities and begin the process of what became known as gentrification, in which there were sort of urban pioneers, young white people brought in to, you know, kind of reclaim space, artists and, you know, as the forefront of a movement to reshape.
That's media, right. Activists.
Yeah, that's right. You know, and the constitution played out in different ways. You know, young urban professionals in some cities, you know, the gay community was used in that way. San Francisco, you know, black community was pretty much broken up by an expansion of the gay community into some of its territory. So there were a lot of different contradictions that were used in that process. But, you know, he was a theoretician of the mass incarceration that took place over the ensuing two decades and of, you know, really what we saw here in L.A. with, you know, crack cocaine and the gang warfare. I mean, the people who put out this kind of theory of low-intensity warfare did see it being carried out, you know, at home and abroad. And I think that's one of the points I would like to get back to, is the kind of seamlessness of this empire. It's not like one thing is happening there and something different is happening here. The same thing is happening in both cases. I remember, you know, being from New York, if you look back through New York history, you know, that whole process of austerity was something that was imposed on New York City as well as they imposed it in Manila or somewhere else. You know, they forced New York to cut back on social services and cut back on, you know, the safety net in favor of, you know, feeding corporate interests, you know, redevelopment of the city on an even more corporate model than it had been, and also public safety, you know, building up that sector of law enforcement and, you know, the whole broken windows theory and so on was put forward in that period of time. But to go back to Huntington in the more recent period has been this theoretician that this kind of a fortress Europe, that white civilization, which he sees as the only civilization, really is kind of embattled and at odds, and very similar to some of the anti-immigrant stuff that's been put out from the very hardcore right wing of like seeing a threat to in this country, you know, from Mexican migration and population, seeing a threat in Europe from Muslim and African migration. And then seeing that globally somehow that the Europe has to marshal its forces and gird up for a war with Islam. Now, as I say, I don't think that's the dominant line. And I think you can see how it's been played out currently with Bush, that there are people well to the right, as unbelievable as that might seem, well to the right of George Bush, you know, urging, you know, this kind of strategy of like, you know, war to the hilt against, you know, 50, 60 states, you know, and I think it's still a possibility and a prospect that they will pursue, you know, after they polish up Afghanistan, they'll pursue the same thing in Somalia, they'll pursue the same thing in Iraq, the same thing in the Philippines. And as I say, they've made commitments in the Philippines to do some of this. And in Colombia, they've said repeatedly that they see the FARC and some of the other forces in Colombia as part of this global problem of terrorism. And they still maintain this idea of fighting 2.5 wars, you know, simultaneously. And so they want the capacity to, you know, fight a fairly big war in Asia and a fairly big war in Latin America and still have a half a war somewhere else that they can play around with, you know. So I think that Huntington's ideas are very much in play still. But I think that the predominant line is still to try to pursue this through neocolonial methods. And so I think that's why you see, for example, Bush saying that, you know, that they favor Palestinian statehood or a state for he's actually come out and said Palestine for the first time, as opposed to Palestinian, you know, to use a noun instead of an adjective, apparently is a, you know, statecraft. Yes, well, he might not, but the Palestinians do. you know, the reason that they've gone very lightly on the Saudis in this whole period, I mean, because if anybody has harbored terrorism and promoted Osama bin Laden, it's clearly been in Saudi Arabia. But they need the Saudis, and they need, you know, what used to be called Arab reaction. You know, there are forces in Muslim society and Arab societies that are quite content to be incorporated within the imperialist system, and they're trying to rely on that. And the same thing in Asia and Latin America and so on. They have always had the ability to cultivate elements of those societies that will line themselves up. And we were talking about Putin before, and Putin is definitely in that same mold because, however, Russia is, you know, historically a much different country. It was an empire at one point and still has, you know, contained within the Russian Federation some imperial aspects, and it extends, you know, from Europe well into Asia and North Asia, and has interests, you know, a sphere of influence, let's say, in the old traditional imperial sense in Central and South Asia, has ties to India. Russia is trying to, you know, use what it has, which is much diminished, certainly, for, you know, to maintain its advantage. And there always are national contradictions within these kind of imperial battles.
Could you discuss the Iranian question?
Well, I think this is also very pertinent because, again, to look back at how the and to the question of neocolonialism and who the United States has relied on and dealt with, I would say, despite appearances, Iran under the mullahs and you know, Khomeini and that regime has always actually been quite pro-U.S. and pro-imperialist. And if you look at how they came in, there was a revolutionary movement in Iran prior to Khomeini's taking power. And it was, I would have to say, an authentically revolutionary movement. There were many different forces in Iranian society. And if you go back, obviously, to the U.S. imposed the Shah in the 50s, the Shah had basically abdicated. There was a, you know, secular and civilian government. There was Mossadegh was the prime minister elected. They made the mistake of nationalizing the oil, and of course immediately became number one on the hit list. And so very quickly in that period of time, the CIA fomented a coup, brought the Shah back in, and you know, resolved that question for a generation or so. In the 70s, it reemerged much more strongly. The imperialism was on the defensive. And I think this is something I want to try to emphasize a little more than we have at this point, is that this is something that's in struggle, and it's in struggle within us individually. It's in struggle in the world. It's in struggle in the empire. Empires are inherently unstable and eventually self-destructive. And there is no empire that really has, you know, empires fall apart. They disintegrate. They're destroyed. They crumble. And so, sometimes when I do give this speech, I talk about Shelley has this famous poem about Ozymandias. And, you know, it's like the poem basically goes, somebody's out in the shifting sands and comes upon the pedestal or the base of what was once a massive statue. Obviously, it says, I am Ozymandias, you know, all who see me, you know, tremble. But there's nothing there, you know. And, you know, Ozymandias, whoever he was, had crumbled to dust and blown away. And, you know, that is what happens to empires, is that the bigger they come, the harder they fall. It's impossible to really sustain an empire forever because you're suppressing the natural desire of people to, you know, have their own culture, their own societies, and freedom. And so the U.S. empire is no exception to that. But they have been a very sophisticated and very effective empire at cloaking and incorporating people into their imperial ambitions. But in the 60s and 70s, imperialism was on the defensive. And we saw, you know, this massive upsurge post-World War II of people in Africa, people in Asia, Latin America, pursuing decolonization. And the United States began to intervene in those battles. And so we got into, you know, we went in really against Lumumba, let's say, in Africa. We went in, you know, to the Philippines. We went into, we supported the British in Malaysia. We supported the French in Vietnam, you know, and lost many of those battles. In other words, the Africans persisted and became independent, and the decolonizing efforts of the last remnants of European empires, which was the, you know, sort of white supremacist regimes that declared unilateral independence in Rhodesia and in South Africa, and then the Portuguese colonies, all of them were facing, you know, armed struggles that were winning. And, you know, there was war in the Philippines, there was war in Palestine, Israel, you know, there was war in Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, Indochina, you know, the state of war existing in Korea and Latin America. There were insurgencies in, you know, almost every country, Brazil, Argentina, Chile, you know, people elected to power in Chile with an anti-imperialist and socialist. And so the United States was backing up, retreating, you know, and in this country, what Jimmy Carter characterizes as a malaise, you know, but was actually many, many people breaking with imperialism and a kind, you know, what we talk about the 60s and the 70s, that was about anti-colonial struggles that emerged inside the United States, the Black Panther Party, the American Indian Movement, the Young Lords, you know, different Asian American forces, and many white people, working class people, middle class people, young people, you know, different movements for liberation that were learning those lessons and saying, yes, we want to create a different kind of world. You know, we want gay liberation, women's liberation, human liberation. You know, and so 68, 69, 70, you know, this was blossoming all around the world. And the United States began to try to figure out how to launch a counteroffensive. In this country, it took the form of COINTELPRO, which was a concerted military effort directed against particularly the Black Liberation Movement, the Black Panther Party, also against the American Indian Movement, you know, resulting in, we've seen, you know, dozens of people arrested and many, many killed in this country, political prisoners from those movements. And globally, the same kind of thing was being carried out, taking place. And one of the key places that that counteroffensive began, I think, was actually in the Middle East. And the first one was with, this is under Jimmy Carter, basically coming in 76. The one people are more familiar with is Camp David. Carter was able to essentially suborn the Egyptians, you know, to bribe the Egyptians into having a separate peace with the Israelis and say, okay, we are taking Egypt out of the equation. Colossal transformation. I mean, really shifted the entire balance of world power in many, many ways. And tremendous victory for U.S. imperialism in a period in which victories were few and far between for U.S. imperialism. And so to this day, Egypt and Israel always receive the same amount of money, you know, which is in the $2 billion range a year of economic aid because Egypt was bought off. And the, you know, they didn't want to continue the war. They didn't want to be in the position of, you know, but that was the genesis of a lot of what we've seen now in this. I mean, the first Islamic fundamentalist movements were the Egyptian Islamic Brotherhood out of that. And of course, they killed Sadat, you know, who signed off on Camp David. The other counteroffensive that was launched was actually Khomeini. Now, you may find that ridiculous, but Iran was crumbling. I mean, the Iranian revolution was massive. It was popular. It was in the cities. They had clandestine revolutionary forces against the Shah of various forms and forces, the two major ones of which were a group called the OIPFG, the Organization of the Iranian People's Fedayeen Guerrillas. The Fedayeen is just like a fighter, guerrilla fighters. And the other one was a group called the Mujahideen, but it was not the Mujahideen that you see now. They were a kind of a social revolutionary Islamic force in Iran fighting against not so much secularism, but you know, imperialist domination of Iran and the fact that the Shah was essentially selling out the Iranian people and enriching himself. And then also in Iranian society, there were forces very sympathetic to the Soviets, the Tudeh Party, which was a kind of reformist socialist party in the cities with, you know, ties to the Soviet Union. And so those forces, as the Shah's regime became more and more unstable, were very, very threatening to U.S. interest and continued domination. And so this is prior to Reagan. Carter sent Warren Christopher, who later became the Christopher Commission, Secretary of State under Clinton and so on. But he was a well-trusted aide of Democratic regimes over a long period of time. He had been part of the actually McCone Commission in L.A., which was run by the CIA. And after the Watts Rebellion, he was part of he was a liaison person between justice and the military on the use of armed forces to put down the rebellions in Detroit when Martin Luther King was killed, and was involved in the use of military intelligence operations against the 68 Democratic Convention. So when the Democrats finally do come back, he's a well-trusted man. He is sent by Carter to Paris to meet with Khomeini and sort of vet him out and see, is he somebody who could, sort of pull their chestnuts out of the fire? And basically gives a series of briefings to Khomeini and his sort of intelligence chief, who was someone from the Iranian military who, because of the Islamic thing, became convinced that the Shah was too weak and was eroding his base of support, and that Khomeini was the bet. And so they were briefed by U.S. intelligence about what was going on in Iran, what was going on with the Shah. And essentially, they were being ushered back into. And if you remember that period of time, the Shah was pulled out, for medical care. And Khomeini goes in and very quickly imposes this regime, the Islam, carries out the Islamic Revolution.
He was living in Paris at that time. He was living in
Khomeini
exile.
Was, yeah. Yes. Khomeini was living in exile in the West and sending audio tapes, basically, in to Iran, which was circulated. But he was, within the context of what was happening in Iran, a relatively marginal figure. I mean, he had a base of support among the mullahs, but he did not necessarily have a popular base, because a lot of the popular movements were involved in a much more authentically revolutionary process. But he essentially struck a deal with imperialism at that time, but he double-crossed, particularly with Carter. There was a double-cross. Once he came in and took power, he had to find a way, Khomeini did, to pacify a lot of elements to his left. And so the Iranian students and the takeover of the U.S. embassy, kind of represents that. It was like his front to say, no, I'm an anti-imperialist and I'm going to let you carry out attacks on the great Satan.
But you're saying that didn't happen in his direction? That was Mujahideen or Fedayeen motivated?
No. I think that was happening in his direction, but I'm saying that it was a concession. In other words, he had to accommodate himself to forces well to his left in order to cement his control at that time. But that was not the main thrust of what they did. The main thrust of what they did was they imposed Islamic law. They imposed Sharia. They began to liquidate, in fact. They did what the Savak and the Shah had been unable to do, which was they destroyed the actual revolutionary organizations. And they carried out a very, very brutal repression against authentically revolutionary forces in Iranian society, and imposed the current regime, which did not threaten, U.S. economic interest or imperial interest or domination of the oil and so on, but accommodated themselves to it. Now, the double cross was involved with Carter in particular, that even though the Democrats had ushered them in, Reagan and Bush had that whole fear of the October surprise that, maybe Carter would, get the hostages home before the election and be reelected. And so, then the Bush team goes in to offer, Khomeini even a sweeter deal than they had been offered by the Democrats, and said, okay, well, we'll keep the hostages till Reagan is elected. I should say that a man named Farah Mansour, who's an Iranian, is the person who told me. It's not something I discovered on my own, but he's somebody. When I wrote the book White Lies, White Power, it was based on a lot of research I had done previously, and I had been involved in a lot of struggles about police brutality here in Los Angeles. Again, this is about the seamlessness of the empire. And so I had exposed a bunch of stuff about Christopher, not the business I just told you about going to Paris, because I didn't know about it. But I was circulating these papers, which eventually got bound into the book "White Lies, White Power," and about Christopher. And Christopher, you know, was in government, out of government, in government, out of government. He was the sort of what do you call that? The managing partner of O'Melveny & Myers, which is like the main imperial law firm here in Southern California, in Los Angeles, when he was not in government. And so I didn't like him because O'Melveny & Myers is the law firm that the school board has always brought in to try to break the teachers union, which I'm part of. But so I was following up about him and discovered that essentially when he was nominated by Carter, he was nominated by Carter to be, I think, Undersecretary of Defense. I forget. He went back and forth from like state, and he worked with Cyrus Vance in several different governments. And so he was, I think he was Undersecretary of Cyrus Vance for Jimmy Carter. And at that time, he was questioned about his role in the use of military intelligence against the 68 demonstrators in Chicago. And he denied categorically that it had anything to do with it. When he was renominated by Clinton, it came back up. And by that point, there was documentary evidence of memos with his signature on them. And they just, you know, I mean, he had perjured, and on top of having done it in the first place, he had perjured himself about having done it, and nothing was done about it whatsoever. He just was Secretary of State.
Could you just be sidebar what exactly he was doing to Rubin and Hoffman and those guys? To the Chicago 8, to the demonstrators, to...
He signed off on the use of military intelligence, U.S. Army intelligence, inside, you know, operating inside Chicago, you know, under the guise of the Justice Department. But, you know, it was probably unconstitutional, illegal use of the military. I don't think they were actually killing people, obviously, but they were involved in counter-surveillance and espionage and other activities. I don't know if every detail of it has ever come out, but he denied having approved it, and in fact he did. So anyway, I put that out, and Farah happened to see it and was so shocked to see somebody attacking Warren Christopher. He said, "Oh, I have to show you the rest of this stuff, what he had done in Iran for Carter." And I think that's another aspect of this is that the Democratic Party and the role it has played, because it is a party of empire. And when this whole struggle began to emerge, people went back and somebody looked at, like, for example, interviews with Zbigniew Brzezinski, who was, you know, when Kissinger was out, he was in, you know. But what difference did it make? I mean, Kissinger is, everybody knows what a war criminal he is. But Brzezinski said that, no, we pulled the Mujahideen together in 78 before the Soviets went into Afghanistan. We were trying to, it was like the tar baby. It was like, you know, they created the briar patch to draw the Soviets in and get them stuck and mired down. They financed it. They built it up. They sent, you know, they used the Saudis and other forces to train them and inculcate them and begin to attack the Afghani government. And there had been, you know, in that same upsurge, that same period of time, there was a coup or whatever, palace revolution or something in Afghanistan, in which the sort of modernizing, westernizing, the people interested in sort of transforming Afghani society throughout, you know, essentially the people who had been allied with the old king and reactionary forces and said, no, we're going to have coeducational education. We're going to, you know, be in the 20th century. We're going to, and so before the Russians came in, you know, but they were, you know, identified with, sympathetic to, whatever. So the U.S. was interested in using that as a way to begin this counteroffensive and begin to shift the thread of, you know, human history. You know, which way is it going? Is it going against the empire, or can we, you know, having been driven out of Vietnam, driven out of, you know, Rhodesia and so on, can we begin to try to drive the wedges the other way? So they picked Afghanistan as the place that they were going to start, you know, shifting that back more aggressively against the Soviets. And if you remember that period, you know, the Russians did get drawn in. They were invited by the Najibullah government to say, please support us. We're under attack by these terrorists. And we need your support. And so they were bordering countries of that time. I mean, all of that was the Soviet Union right up to the border of Afghanistan. And, you know, the comparable situation would be, let's say, if there had been an uprising in Mexico, we know that the United States would go in, you know, and so the Russians did. But it was a trap, you know, designed by the CIA, the National Security Advisor, under the Democrats. And just one example, you know, because they are fighting for an empire. And the differences that exist between the Republicans and the Democrats are the differences of what's the best way to defend and expand that empire. It's not about changing anything for the better. It's just like, how can you marshal the best alliance or the best array of forces or draw the most people in from different sectors of your own society to participate in that imperial project? And so the Democrats tend to try to base their coalition on labor and, you know, social movements and, you know, certain middle class sectors. And the Republicans like to base theirs on, you know, the old Confederacy, now that it shifted hands to them. You know, they won that away from the Democrats, and, you know, the West, landowners, you know, mineral extractors, resource, you know, oil, and, you know, these sort of Christian elements. But they have different selling points to their different crowds, but they're both, you know, interested in the same general set of goals.
Talk to us about who are the operatives behind the empire, because I think if you talk to most Americans, they would say, we're not an empire, we're a democracy. And, you know, most people really live in the dark, and the sort of propagandistic nature of the empire and how essential that is to keeping this empire going. So who's the empire? Who wants to keep it going? And what's their agenda?
Well, I do think there has been mass participation in the empire. I think that is the issue in the struggle. I mean, if you look at, like I say, the Jacksonians, but a lot of other things. Clinton, for example, when Clinton was pushing Fast Track, he went to the AFL-CIO and he basically said, this is straight up. I mean, he said, we're 5% of the world's population. We have 35% of the world's resources. If you want to keep it that way, we need Fast Track. You know, I'm the best deal you're going to get. He just came out and said, I'm the best deal you're going to get. You have to back me on this, and then you'll get your piece of the pie. In so many words, you know, I mean, one of the more amazing speeches I've ever heard given by a U.S. politician. But, you know, you can find it in his files. You know, it was quite astounding. And, you know, it's like people, none are so blind as those who will not see. I think that people, you know, it's like Oz the Magnificent, you know, pay no attention to the man in the corner. Everybody knows he's there, you know, cranking it all out. And, I know that, for example, a couple weeks ago, my TV went on the Fritz. And I don't think of myself as watching a lot of TV, but as soon as I didn't have it, I noticed that it was unsettling to me that I couldn't, while I was on the computer, have the TV in the background. And I think that, you know, there's a tremendous amount of anxiety about what we are, because there's this huge contradiction built into it. Like I said, between, you know, the certain ideals, certain desires that people have for freedom and solidarity that people experience in, you know, human contact, and then this other thing, which is ugly and horrible, that is also inside us. It's not like it's only out there. It is something that people have incorporated. And so people want to be numbed. You know, I think one of the things that happened after the attacks, you know, was everybody was very, very unsettled. You know, people had a sense of powerlessness, and people had a sense of fear and anxiety, and people don't like that feeling. I mean, although you have to, you know, it's like anything else. If you want to liberate yourself, you have to experience, you know, you have to understand, okay, I'm an alcoholic, whatever the business is, you know, you have to recognize what you're hooked on, you know what I mean? And that you're hooked, and, you know, and how you've sort of built a character structure and an economy around it. And it's going to be very painful to stop. You know, there's not like just going to be another, like, I want a new drug, you know, that, you know, doesn't have any side effects, you know, but there is no such drug, you know. And so I think that there's a lot of complicity for that reason, that people, you know, are fearful of what the alternative, what the consequences are for themselves and in the world. And I think that's the other thing that's very important, and we haven't talked about enough. It's like, to go back to the question of the vulnerability of the empire and the that is finite. It's not, you know, like what I think what people have to understand is that when you look at something that big and that powerful, you think, oh God, it's the most powerful nation in the world. It's the richest, we're the richest nation on earth. And on the one hand, it's like people want to be part of that. You know, there's like that identification you have with it. And on the other hand, there's like a tremendous intimidation factor, even if you are part of it, that, you know, who am I, little insignificant nobody, to like go up against the empire, you know? But what people have to understand is that all of that wealth and power is constantly being extracted from the people who are exploited and oppressed. And that includes us inside the belly of the beast, you know, it's, you know, the people who run the system are very, very fearful, actually. I mean, they're more fearful than we are, probably, because they understand these things and they get all the intelligence and all the information and they know the stuff that doesn't go out about their vulnerabilities and about their weaknesses and about the potential that people have to resist and the danger to them. I mean, it's like they can't abide by, like, Mumia, for example. I mean, how does Mumia Abu Jamal threaten them? But he's like one person, but he says something and people can, you know, see a spark of like humanity and something else and different way to understand the world. And, you know, that's infectious in a positive way. And it's very, very threatening to the powers that be that people begin to either extract themselves or extract it from themselves. I don't know if you've seen like all those alien movies, you know, it's like,
you know, so the empire is fragile. Let's assume that the tragedy in New York obviously points to the fragility and the recuperative tendencies of the empire. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we move on from there into people trying to discover their own power, as it were, inside an empire that tells them on a daily basis they are to be dominated and they are to behave. What would you suggest that people consider in their own lives to contradict the numbing forces of empire?
Well, I think, you know, there are different things. I think one thing is really looking at it and seeing it for what it is, which I think is scary to do, and to recognize that, I think it was Reagan or Nixon said, like, watch what they hand, listen to what they say, but watch their hands. You know, and on that level, you really have to, I think the first thing is to be willing to recognize what reality is, to face reality and to see the dynamics there, and that we are an empire in the same way that the Roman Empire. And you know, they asked Gandhi, you know, what about Western civilization? He said, well, it would be a good idea, you know, that, but Western civilization is based on that imperial model, you know, and when they created the empire, you know, we sometimes talk about the nation state, but we have to understand that they're really empire states, all of them. I mean, if you look at how France was amalgamated or how Spain, you know, 1492, what did? They expelled the Moors, they expelled the Jews, they suppressed all, you know, they didn't just speak Spanish in Spain. They spoke Catalan and, you know, a lot of other different languages, actually. But they married two houses together and they say, okay, we're Spain, you know, but Spain itself was an empire, you know, England, you know, the United Kingdom of Great Britain, Northern Ireland, you know, Great Britain is an empire, you know, they suppressed the wealth and, you know, so all of that is built in and people have to recognize that that's the thing. So if you're thinking about sort of coming out, you know, against the state, you have to recognize that that's the kind of state it is that we live under and live in. I think that beginning to make human contact with other people, I think, you know, one of the things that kind of got washed away by all the stuff with the anti-war movement and the war was what was going on before that, which was a very, very big upsurge of international solidarity. And, you know, so kind of first time since the 60s where there was this sense of, okay, there's kind of a counteroffensive, the pendulum is swinging a little bit. You know, we have this anti-globalization or global justice movement where, you know, French peasants and, you know, Indian, you know, women and, you know, Africans and, you know, we're actually making contact with each other and saying, no, we're, you know, hey, you know, we're a piece of the same puzzle, a piece of the same pie. We have common interests. We have connections that, you know, it doesn't have to be mediated by the empire. We can have direct, you know, global solidarity, human solidarity between different people, learn from each other, see what their struggles are, you know, connect to the indigenous people, you know, around the world. You know, the Australian Aboriginal people are struggling, you know, for something that, the, you know, in Canada, in the U.S., in Latin America, Central America, Mexico. You know, if you look at the Zapatistas, one of the things they are is they're an aspect of that upsurge of people saying, no, we've been fighting since Columbus. And that's very, very important. You know, the Puerto Ricans have been fighting since Columbus. They were directly colonized by Christopher Columbus on a second or third voyage. He went to Puerto Rico and he claimed it for Spain and he brought slaves, and, you know, they have been colonized since, whatever, it's 1495 or something. 1898, the U.S. took it over, but they're still colonized, yet they have a sense of Puerto Rican identity based on the amalgamation of the Taino, the indigenous people, the Africans, the, you know, Spanish who came and settled and, you know, were oppressed as working people, and they created this idea of the Jibaro, which is, you know, a Puerto Rican specific term of the amalgamation of those nationalities into a new creation of independence. And so they're still resisting U.S. imperialism. And in Puerto Rico, you know, it's like every agency under the sun is there. You know, the ONI, the Office of Naval Intelligence, which was for like the last century what the CIA has been for this one. But from, you know, the period of the time we talked about at the beginning of like the U.S. beginning that insular, you know, it was the naval intelligence that ran all those operations around the world. So the ONI is still there in Puerto Rico. And the biggest naval base, having closed down Subic and Clark, is, you know, Roosevelt Roads in Puerto Rico. And yet the Puerto Ricans are still resisting. The FBI is there, the CIA is there, the ONI is there, the DIA, you know, everybody under the sun. And they have infiltrated the Puerto Rican independence movement and, you know, been caught killing people and, and yet they are still saying, no, we are Puerto Ricans and we will never be swallowed and digested by the empire. And so I think that that's a really important lesson. You know, if you look at Gandhi, and I'm not, you know, a Gandhian pacifist by any means, but, you know, what did Gandhi do? He said, we're going to resist. If the British Empire went in and destroyed what was a much more advanced economic enterprise, but it was a handicrafts-based, you know, cotton. You know, all the stuff we know about globalization now and free trade, but it wasn't free trade. It was like direct colonial regime, and they broke down, you know, that economy with cotton, slave cotton, and, you know, the mills of Manchester and so on to destroy that. So eventually Gandhi said, okay, we're going to do homespun. We're going to go back to where we were, and you know, everybody will have a little wheel to, like, you know, not even a loom, but it's like the stage before a loom. I forget it's not a treadle. I forget what you call it, but you're spinning. You're spinning, you know, before you even loom it into fabric. First, you have to spin the cotton. And he wore what he wore, you know, it was this little white shift, you know, to say, I'm not going to buy, you know. And it was about resistance. The Puerto Ricans have this concept they call retraimiento, which I don't even know how it translates, but basically it's saying, we are going to resist. We will not participate in our own oppression and exploitation. And that is tremendously powerful. And how you do it, you know, it depends. You know, maybe you'll do it in the environmental area. Maybe you'll do it, in the women's movement, the gay movement. People have to begin to say, no, I'm going to reassert an identity and a struggle, and I'm going to do it in conscious solidarity with other people. I think that's been the failure in the past, or the failure of the movements of the 60s, was that people kind of splintered off. And I don't think that's inherent in having that identity, because I think you want to have identities that allow people to resist and to determine who they are. But you have to have, particularly from white people involved in these struggles, you have to be in conscious solidarity with other people who are oppressed, and to recognize what are your ties and your stakes. What do you have to, you know, give up or let go or repudiate, you know, in order to have the solidarity, in order to have the unity. But I think that is very powerful. And I think that, you know, as I say, I think that it's a sort of a tapestry or fractals or all the stuff we've learned about sort of how the world works. You know, if you have a hologram, you know, every piece of the hologram has the whole picture that's in the hologram in it. And, you know, you turn it around, you can see it, you know, and fractals, you know, are like that. If you look at the coast of Norway at any, you know, magnification from a satellite, it's just the same thing, reproduced down. You know, so we're living in a system, and it's part of us, and we're part of it. And any place that we can start to extract ourselves from it, or extract it from ourselves, begins to weaken that whole structure. And they're aware of that. They understand, you know, that's why they fight very, very fiercely to, you know, liquidate any kind of resistance, any kind of oppression, liberation.
So now for the $64 question. Sure. Let's assume for a moment that there is a variety of projects undertaken toward the decolonization of the West, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
And we find ourselves some period down the road in a possible world that doesn't look like the world we're living in right now. Can you describe a vision of what that economic social system looks like?
Well, I think that there would be a lot less difference between work and play. I think that, economies and agriculture would be organized on a much more sort of bioregional basis and then trading between them. I think that most things would be a lot smaller. I think we would have gotten off dependence on oil and internal combustion engine to a great degree. I think that, people would be engaged in cooperative economics and we would not be sort of hooked on constant expansion and because, the profit system is based on this constant, ratcheting up of more and more and more and we're ripping it out of the planet and from the future of future generations. The Native American talk about seventh generation. If you're using something, you have to think about what's going to happen, seven generations from now, with completely antithetical to, capitalism and imperialism in the West, which is, now and ASAP and even if you compare, like, the U.S. is probably the worst because we have this total historical amnesia in which we have to obliterate the past constantly as compared to like some other societies, even which are capitalist also. And I think that has to do with settlerism, and we're creating we're rewriting our history because we don't really like what it looked like. So I think that, people would be in probably, more loving and less possessive. I think there are a whole variety of changes that would happen psychologically, emotionally. I think that, we would have a much clearer understanding that there's only one race, which is the human race, and that that whole fabric of racism that was created by colonialism, because we didn't used to know about races. People didn't have that ideology or that idea or divide the world in that way. I mean, people with different colors didn't matter. What they worried about was religions, maybe. People were pagans or infidels or, Muslims or something. But racism began with that colonial project of, Europe beginning to dominate other societies and capture land and impose, private property and land on people who lived in another way. And so then those people had to be defined as, inferior and, racially by the marker of their skin. And the same way with, the imposition of, slavery and capitalist slavery, which is much different from the slavery that existed, before that on the planet, which was about, private property and people in the same way as private property and land. And it was for, the purposes of exploitation, intergenerational. And so again, they had to be a brand that was created to say, okay, the skin color will brand you as a slave. And, I think if we begin to abolish that system, then we'll recognize that, there's all kinds of diversity. I mean, genetically, it's quite clear that there's the largest sort of genetic diversity on the planet is among Africans. And apart from what exists among Africans, which is quite diverse, there's very little genetic diversity among the entire human race. And so, that distinction would begin to dissolve and disappear. Even the question of the borders and the boundaries and what's Europe. I mean, it's like, is Russia Europe? Is Russia Asia? I don't know if you've ever seen the Peters projection map. It's a very interesting map. If you think about the map that you and I grew up with and what they teach us in high school, just as an example of propaganda or elementary school, we see a map in which the United States is on the center of the map, first of all, which is, okay, anybody can be at the center, but obviously we're the United States, we're at the center. But the map of the rest of the world relates to England as the center, because it's the Greenwich Meridian and that's the center of the world, because England was the empire that, kind of was in control when they started doing all that cartography. But if you look at the map, the one most of us know is called the Mercator projection. And the Mercator projection is a projection that's designed for people who are sailing, so that if you're sailing on, quote unquote, a straight line, which on the surface of a globe, obviously, is not going to be really straight, but that it's a straight line is straight and north or south, east or west, you can project it. But what that projection happens to do is it magnifies the north dramatically. And so you all know the map I'm talking about. It's the map in which Greenland is larger than South America. And the United States is vastly larger than Brazil, and Alaska is much bigger than Mexico. But that's not the real world. And on the actual planet, the dimensions and relations are much different. And the Peters projection is a map which shifts that. So the shapes are no longer the shapes that we recognize exactly, but the relative areas are the same. And what you discover is that, you know, as has been said, Europe is a pimple on the ass of Asia. And, you know, when they talked about the Mediterranean, they understood a world in which they only knew that world. But they had a pretty clear idea that that was kind of the middle. You know, the Mediterranean was the middle of the world, and there was the sort of European, and then there was an African, you know, world underneath it, you know, at least equal and actually much bigger. So Africa is by far the largest continent, although it doesn't appear that way on the map. The U.S. could fit pretty comfortably, it's the 48 states, roughly in Brazil, in the real world. And we have to begin to understand what world we're living in, you know, which is not the world of the maps or the map that's in our heads, but is this other, the real map. And Brazil is predominantly an African and Indian nation. You know, it's most of the people in Brazil are people widely of African descent. I mean, there was obviously some Portuguese who settled it, but mostly it was the slaves. And they're worried about Brazil. It's a rising economic power, and it's a third world nation, and all that that means. You know, it's not European. I think that looking at reality and then beginning to make these contacts and relations and those are steps. I don't think you can predict exactly what the world will look like now, because, you know, your predictions are based on, it's like Huntington or anybody else. You're culture bound. So I think that people will shape the world in a much different way, and we'll know more about what it can be when we begin to unshackle ourselves.
That was Michael Novick, publisher of Turning the Tide and author of White Lies, White Power. The interviewers were Casey Calloway and Stephen Starr of the LAIMC.
First they occupied our country, then they spread their vicious lies. Evil propaganda filled our ranks with double-dealing spies. Cordoned off a reservation, built a wall all around it, drove us all into this ghetto, and our city'd never be as the Nazis found. First no one believed it, just what horrors lay in store. The sound of boots upon the staircase, of leather gloves upon the door. Some of us they sent to labor, to slave for them to the last breath. Most of us they sent to Auschwitz, 500,000 people sent to a pointless early death. There were those of us who worked with them, a desperate effort to survive. Even when our numbers were so few, maybe 60,000 left alive. People said we had no chances. By then we all knew they were right. It was 1943, and we, the walking dead, made up our minds to fight. I remember Warsaw. We stood side by side. The Star of David flew above the ghetto. There we lived and there we died. We cleansed the ghetto of their agents, dug a maze of tunnels underground. We begged the Allies give us weapons, but empty words was all we found. So we saved each precious bottle, made bombs of rags and gasoline. And in this crypt of mindless carnage, we waited in the shadows for the final scene. It was the month of April. The SS came marching in, singing songs to praise Der Führer. and all his Aryan kin, to see the shock upon their faces. We'd show the world on this day. We'd not go like sheep off to the slaughter. With the last blood running through our hearts, we'd make the devils pay. I remember Warsaw. We stood side by side. The Star of David flew above the ghetto. There we lived and there we died. Positions. Each escape route planned. We rained down Molotovs upon them. With each retreat, another stand. Yes, we killed the Nazi bastards. They lay dying by the score. We made each scarce bullet count. And as the demons ran, we killed some more. For one full month, the battle raged. And the word spread all around that it wasn't over till every building had been leveled to the ground. I am the ghost of the apocalypse, and these few words I have to tell. Let it never be forgotten that for 4 long weeks we fought, we stood up before we fell. I remember Warsaw. We stood side by side. The Star of David flew above the ghetto. There we lived and there we died.
That was David Rovics singing I Remember Warsaw, a song about the too little, too late resistance of the Jews in the Warsaw Ghetto in Poland against the Nazis. The Nazis were able to do what they did because of the good Germans. The Germans who did nothing, kept their heads in their beer, and pretended not to know. There is a line in our time, and in every time, between those who believe that all men are created equal and those who believe that some men and women and children are expendable in the pursuit of power. There is a line in our time and in every time between the defenders of human liberty and those who seek to master the minds and souls and bodies of others. This coming week, from September 25th to 29th, Americans will converge to oppose the power of global corporate domination. It's time to stand up and be counted. For more information, see www.globalizethis.org.
You still catch me napping. One day and they'll kill me. Then I'll be gone. But that won't be my end for my guns.
If you have an event you'd like us to announce or an issue you'd like us to cover on the program, you can contact us at our website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content.